This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Hello again. You're listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio, where you get to listen in on the conversations that doctors have amongst themselves. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by Docs for Patient Care Foundation, promoting freedom of choice in healthcare. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Karuchek, and I'm delighted that you've decided to spend a little bit of time with me today. Today's show comes from Steamboat Springs, Colorado, where I'll be attending the 6th Annual Freedom Conference sponsored by the Steamboat Institute. Please give us an email at the Doctor's Lounge if you would like to give us some feedback. I would be delighted to hear from you, either if it's just to let you know or let me know that you are listening. The email address is doctorslounge@americaswebradio.com. Once again, that's doctorslounge@americaswebradio.com. I would be delighted to hear from you. Well, we're here late in the summertime. Summer is slowly yielding to fall. Summer vacations are over. And in the Southeast, at least, almost all the children are back in school, thank heaven. Happy for us, unhappy for them. With my kids, it's be time for me to stop spending so much time on the baseball diamond and time to get back to tutoring. All the usual stuff this year. It's going to be physics, history, English, algebra, all of the basic stuff. Today, we're going to talk about what many consider to be the most important trend in health information technology, and that is what we call mobile health or telehealth or telemedicine. There's lots of different names for it. One of the most popular acronyms in the health information technology world is to call it mHealth. So we'll call it mHealth from here on out. That's little m, big H, health. For patients, this is a big deal. Can mHealth save you trips to the doctor and give you the same level of care without having to bother with leaving work, parking the car, paying for parking, waiting in the waiting room, all that extra undocumented expenses that go with seeing a doctor, even as an outpatient? Or does all of this high-tech shortcutting cut the quality of care? Maybe we don't know what those standards of care are supposed to be, and there are certainly lots of unanswered questions for patients. For doctors, we have the same thing. Maybe mobile health, mHealth, is a great way to improve accessibility to your patients, a great way to improve efficiency. Now I don't have to pay staff to check them in, check them out, all that kind of thing. Maybe it's a great way to bend the cost curve, or maybe not. Maybe this is just a way to reduce the quality of care or leave us liable for problems that arise from an undefined standard of care. Or maybe we medical professionals are afraid. Maybe we're afraid of change. Many times we're afraid of change for good reason, because we know after many years what works and what doesn't. And change has to come slowly and carefully to the practice of medicine if we're going to protect our patients. So whether you're a doctor or whether you're a patient or many times both, there are many unanswered questions that come from the advent of what's coming, which is mobile health or mobile medicine. And make no mistake, this is coming. It is only a matter of time before this is going to happen. And the question is it going to be executed well or is it going to be executed badly? I decided to do this particular topic today because mobile health has come to my practice, mHealth has come to my practice through my patients. And this is going to happen to every physician out there eventually, but it's happening to me right now. And this is a very interesting story. This is about a patient who came to me last week. I was treating this patient for chronic laryngitis due to acid reflux. And a little background first. This is one of the most common things that I see both as an ear, nose, and throat doctor and as a voice subspecialist. Because acid reflux, without causing any heartburn, can cause a variety of head and neck symptoms, a variety of throat symptoms. It can cause a lump in the throat, difficulty swallowing, throat clearing, hoarseness. Just about every symptom in the head and neck has been linked to reflux, probably at some level by somebody writing a paper. Some people in the specialty have gone a little bit overboard with it, but there is no question that reflux is extremely common. The symptoms can be very variable. It's not like there's one symptom that's a giveaway symptom. And we have a very difficult time achieving an objective diagnosis. There is a test that you can do. It's called a 24-hour pH probe, and you can tell by the name. It takes 24 hours to do. It's very inconvenient. So a lot of times, in fact, all the time, just about. We treat reflux by giving the medicine and treating, and then diagnose it retrospectively. If we give you the medicine and it worked, then we must have had the diagnosis right. And although that's not terribly impractical to do, obviously from a scientific standpoint, we would love to be able to make a diagnosis definitively before we invest the time and the expense and the risk in giving medication. But we don't have that option right now. So this is a patient that I had treated for reflux several weeks ago, started the medicine, talked about the diet, brought them back for their follow-up, and I go in the room and say, how you doing? And the answer was very surprising. He says, my reflux is better. Now, nobody's ever said that to me before with that level of confidence. Usually we go back and talk about all the symptoms we had in the first place, and some symptoms are better and some symptoms are not so better. And so it usually takes a fairly long conversation to figure out whether or not their reflux is getting better or not. But this patient just came right out and said, yeah, my reflux is better. I said, well, that's interesting. How do you know that? And he said he had had a device on his wrist called a Fitbit. F-I-T-B-I-T. You can Google it. It's a device called a Fitbit. And it's a device that goes on your wrist. And it's a very simple device in concept. All it has in it is a motion detector and a wireless link to your smartphone with an app. That's it. And with the data that they have accumulated with how your wrist moves with certain activities, in this particular case, it's sleep, this thing can figure out how many steps you take, how many stairs you take up and down, the distance that you travel, the calories that you burn, and the quality of your sleep. And it turns out that this patient had the ingenuity to use his Fitbit sleep data to document that he was sleeping much better. And he had already figured out that his interruptions in sleep were due to reflux. I suppose he was waking up with heartburn or throat discomfort or something. And he was able to document not only subjectively, because he knew his symptoms were better, but objectively with raw data from his Fitbit that he had fewer sleep interruptions once he'd been on the medication for a couple of weeks. And this was very impressive to me. This is huge for two reasons. One is that I've already mentioned to you here just now, figuring out what's going on with reflux can be very tricky and is often very imprecise. The second issue is that even with sleep, we have a lot of issues trying to figure out what's going on. We treat sleep disorders as part of an ear, nose, and throat practice because of obstructive sleep apnea, which some of you are probably familiar with. That's a situation where your snoring gets so bad it actually obstructs your airway and reduces your sleep quality. I suffer from that myself, and if you heard my show from a couple of weeks ago, heard the story about my old dog and my CPAP machine. Won't go into it again here. Suffice it to say that we have a very difficult time getting good data about how people are sleeping. To do that, you either have to do a home sleep study or a sleep study in a lab. It's very expensive. Insurance often doesn't approve it. And the level of service that we get from sleep labs in general is generally not that good. So we have a really hard time. So this device demonstrated itself not only to be able to give us good data on how people are doing with reflux, but also on how well they're doing with sleep. And the thing only costs $100 retail, so it probably only costs $50 to make. And so we've got a huge potential way to improve how we do what we do for almost no money at all in medical terms. So I went to the literature to see if anybody else had any bright ideas with how to use a Fitbit medically, and it turns out that the Wall Street Journal had recently published an article about two studies, one from Mass General Hospital and one from the Mayo Clinic, talking about how a Fitbit does what it does and what it's good for. And there were two studies, one from Mass General where they combined a Fitbit with a custom smartphone app for diabetics. Right, insulin-resistant diabetics, in order to get them to improve their blood glucose control by improving their exercise and by improving their quality of sleep. And the thing also combined weather data, of all things, and would come up with a way to give patients feedback not only on how they were doing with sleep and exercise, but also to give them sort of a motivational or instructional message of the day to say, well, hey, it's sunny out. You need to go out and exercise outdoors, take a walk, ride a bike, or the weather's going to be bad. You need to stay indoors and lift weights or use an exercise bike or something along those lines. And it turns out that they got objective data to show that they could improve blood sugar control in diabetics using nothing but a Fitbit and a smartphone app. So again, you have the same thing, similar at least, to what I saw in a single patient, and this study was able to expand that to a large group of patients and show that you could improve their health in a significant and measurable way. The second study comes from the Mayo Clinic, and this was from the anesthesia department there, talking about using a Fitbit to identify patients that were at high risk for blood clots following surgery. So a little background information here for those of you who never went through a surgical residency. When you're a surgical intern, one of the challenges that you learn how to deal with is how to get patients to move following surgery. Because if you're having a big surgery, like a chest surgery or an abdominal surgery, obviously the discomfort makes you want to stay in bed. And it turns out that's the worst thing for you, because if you stay in bed after surgery, you're going to get blood clots in your legs. You're going to get fluid accumulating in your lungs. Lots of bad things happen without going into too much detail. You got to get patients to move. And typically, we'll write postoperative orders that say ambulate in the halls, out of bed to chair, or we'll put, you know, sequential compression devices on patients' legs to keep the blood moving and keep the blood clots from forming. So there's the need. You need to get patients to move right after surgery, practically as soon as they wake up. So they used a Fitbit for this, right? The Fitbit has a motion detector in it. So if you put a Fitbit on somebody's wrist in the recovery room, you now get a continuous feed of data to show how much they're moving. And in this study, they were able to identify high-risk patients ahead of time and could document that patients that moved more immediately following surgery were healthier and went home sooner, and patients that didn't move as well had to stay in the hospital longer. And that's a big deal. Again, a very inexpensive device, very simple technology applied in an extremely effective way. And it's not hard to take this whole idea with Fitbits on patients in the recovery room and immediately postoperatively to build a system that identifies the high-risk patients and either gives them automated reminders or deploys human resources of one form or another to get the high-risk patients up and moving. And again, it would be an extremely simple way to make that stuff work. So think about it just for a minute. Now, this has hit me personally in my practice. I went to the literature, found out this is going on with just one very simple device. But let's think about something even bigger, which is the incredibly elaborate system that is already in place, because every single one of your patients, or if you're a patient, every single one of you has a smartphone in your pocket or in your purse. And that means if you're a patient, you have the capacity to be connected to your doctor 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. As a physician, it's obviously looking at it from the other side. You have connectivity to every single one of your patients in real time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's not a pipe dream. It already exists today, right now. Nobody has to pay for it. It's already there. It's already made. And when we get to the next segment in a couple of minutes, we're going to talk about this even further. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
Come on, follow Sniffles to Atlanta's go-to center for breathing easy. Do you suffer from chronic sinus headaches, recurrent sinusitis, facial pain or pressure, and chronic congestion? Well, balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow Sniffles.com. We treat the problem, not the symptom. Chronic sinus symptoms, gone. This could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day, and it's done under local anesthesia. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow Sniffles.com.
This is Dr. Susan Blank, Medical Director for the Atlanta Healing Center. Our team is able to offer a multitude of treatment options, such as quantitative EEG, also known as brain mapping, hormonal and nutritional assessments, neuropsychological testing, and cognitive therapy, along with traditional 12-step facilitation. And we can even offer you, if appropriate, a gentle medically managed detox. Please contact us at 770-696-9862.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Karuchak, and I'm delighted that you've chosen to spend a little time with me today. The Doctor's Lounge is a place in every hospital where doctors go to get a cup of coffee, get a bite to eat, and have conversations amongst themselves about the things that matter to them and matter to their patients. On this show, you get to hear a little bit of what those conversations are like. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit organization that is devoted to patient education, patient empowerment, and free choice in healthcare. In the last segment, we talked about mobile health, otherwise known as mHealth. This is healthcare through your smartphone. Maybe someday you don't need to go to see the doctor in person so much. You can get much of your healthcare through that incredibly powerful computer and communication device that virtually every single one of us carries. Last segment, I related a story where mobile health has come to my practice. I didn't go out and look for it. It came to me through a patient that I had given medication to for acid reflux, had been having some heartburn, some throat discomfort, and came back to me for his follow-up visit and was very confident the medication had worked well. And I asked him how he was so confident. He said he had used a mobile device, a mobile personal healthcare device called a Fitbit, which allowed him to document that his sleep had improved with the use of the medication. And I thought this was a very powerful thing. It was a great idea. I'd never seen it before. I thought it was ingenious. Through a device that costs $100 retail, probably costs only $25 to make, he was able to get information that through normal healthcare channels might cost thousands of dollars to get. And it turns out, if you do a little literature search, that the Fitbit has a bit of official medical research behind it. There's one study that shows the Fitbit can identify high-risk surgical patients in the immediate postoperative period because they don't move around enough. And the Fitbit, through its exercise monitoring and encouragement, can improve blood sugar control in diabetics. Another very powerful thing. So the question is, is mobile health, mHealth, as the industry people call it, is mHealth a good thing or is it a bad thing? So my answer to that is that it can be both or neither, depending on how you implement it. This can be done right and make it a good thing, or it can be done wrong and make it a bad thing. So in this segment, we're going to talk about the good things first, and I promise you in segment three, we're going to talk about the bad things. But first, we're going to talk about the good things. So think about this just for a minute. Think about the power that we have, because every single one of our patients, every single one of you has a smartphone. And it can be reasonably argued that the smartphone is one of the most powerful instruments of social change in easily the last century, since the automobile or the telephone itself. Estimates vary, but one number I got says there's about 5 billion smartphones on the planet. That's well over half the population. And interestingly, about two-thirds of these folks are in undeveloped countries or relatively underdeveloped countries. That sounds surprising at first, but I think it makes sense since cell coverage is very easy to deploy. And in underdeveloped countries, there's no legacy infrastructure that you need to replace or get people to convert from. So here we are, both in this country and all around the world, with everybody having a smartphone. That communication infrastructure is already in place. You don't have to dream it. You don't have to buy it. You don't have to finance it. You don't have to implement it. It's already there. And more importantly, or perhaps just as importantly, it is culturally already accepted. This is not some crazy idea that we're going to put a computer in everybody's hand that's going to be with their telephone. It's already done. Culturally, it's already accepted. Everybody carries a smartphone. Everybody puts apps on their smartphone. And everybody has culturally already gotten used to the idea of wirelessly connecting peripheral devices to the smartphone. You know, microphones, wireless headphones, wireless microphones. We've been doing that for years. Everybody gets it. And so the cultural leap from your wireless earphone to a wireless blood pressure monitor or a wireless bathroom scale or a wireless blood glucose monitor is not a huge cultural jump. It's easy for everyone to accept that. It's widely distributed regardless of how much money you have or whether you have health insurance or not. And just about any doctor out there can tell you a story about a very financially desperate patient who doesn't have insurance or is on Medicaid or something like that, and they may have difficulty keeping up with their medical expenses in your office, but you know what? They all have the top-of-the-line cell phone, and it's available to them, and I'm not judging them for that. I'm saying that because this is an indication of where our priorities are in society. Everybody wants that phone. There are homeless people with cell phones, for crying out loud, so everybody's got the cell phone. And those cell phones are always connected, you know, somewhere along the line. And I don't know exactly where this happened in the last 10 or 15 years. But in the beginning, cell phones were turned off when you weren't using them. And it probably had to do with the fact that at first cell phone minutes were very expensive, maybe 50 cents or a dollar per minute. So everyone was conserving on voice time on a cell phone. So when you weren't using your cell phone, it was turned off. And somewhere along the line, probably about the time that unlimited voice plans came along, we decided we were going to leave our cell phones on all the time, and we were going to leave them on during the night next to our bed. And so we're connected. That network that we're going to rely on to communicate with patients is there 24/7, and with cell phone coverage being what it is, it doesn't matter where you are. So you're connected 24/7, no matter who you are, no matter where you are, no matter how much money you have or you don't have, you are connected. And that is an incredibly powerful thing that is already in place. Right? This model that we have, where we have a phone that is, as far as apps are concerned, a blank sheet of paper. You can create any app you want. Right? The developing language is there. All you have to do is get somebody to write the code for you, and you can create any application you want, and that's exactly what people are doing. If you look on the iPhone website, if you look in the there, you will find about 13,000 health-related applications. Now, the vast majority of these are self-contained, meaning that there's no provider connection. This is just something that a patient uses for self-help or self-improvement, and there's all kind of stuff in there. You know, the biggest category is exercise, weight loss, stress relief, that kind of thing. So you find workout trackers. You find yoga trackers and guides. You find Pilates, jogging, my favorite, which is biking, and I use an app called Map My Ride, which uses GPS and wireless communication with the sensors on your bicycle to keep track of your exercise on your bike. And they have a very elaborate way of reinforcing what you're doing. For instance, last month they had a Tour de France challenge, since the Tour de France is in July. And it just so happened I was on vacation for a week, and I took this Tour de France challenge, and the computer pushed me to ride more and more. And it turns out I was able to ride about 120 miles in 1 week. And in 100 miles, I got this achievement award and a link to share it on Twitter and Facebook, and you think, well, that's kind of dumb. But, you know, the strange thing is it kind of worked. I was pushing for the 100-mile goal, and I got there, and all these – everything was flashing and blinking, and materially it's worthless. But for some reason, there's still some sort of positive reinforcement that goes on inside your head, even though you know there's no rational reason for that to happen. There are other things besides the bikes and the Pilates. There's brain exercises. There's eye exercises, you know, apps for all these things, nutrition apps. The next big category is the hardcore medical apps that are away from the self-improvement and a bit more hardcore medical. There's blood pressure monitors and recording devices, things for diabetes care, arthritis care, things to help you with your headaches, things to help you to stop smoking. Homeopathy applications. Strangely enough, the most expensive applications are the ones that are in my specialty, ear, nose, and throat. There were two applications to help you with tinnitus or ringing in your ears. And these were hugely expensive. There were two of them. One was $60 and the other one was $150. And that stands out like a sore thumb amongst 13,000 apps, which all cost basically between zero, free, and $5. There's very few that are above $5. Many of them are free, and they get their money through advertising that's on the app, and that's fine. You've got medication trackers. You put your medication list in. You put the dosing schedule in for all your medications, and this thing will beep and remind you to take your medicines. There's one called a medical checkup. You enter all your personal information. It will recommend what evaluations you ought to have based on the risk factors that your personal information implies you might have. There are one-patient electronic health record applications where you put everything about your medical history into this thing, and it'll keep up with it for you, and you, instead of having to carry reams of paper around from one doc to another, I presume these things keep it all on your phone. And there are medical references, right? There are things for medical professionals, you know, anatomy atlases, exam prep, board prep, you know, medication references, that kind of thing. You know, ACLS protocols, it stands for acute care life support, things that, you know, you'd use to save patients' lives whose hearts have stopped. All this stuff is in here, 13,000 of them, just covering just about everything, and I could keep listing them the rest of the hour and put you to sleep. I promise I won't do that. All kind of things. And the question becomes, which of these, and it's going to be very few, which of these are actually going to survive? And which of these are going to become the killer app that really brings these things from the periphery of society into the mainstream where they become as ubiquitous as the phones themselves? And this is one of the things I like best about the mobile health space, if you will, is that there is no government rule or law or incentive program that's going to pick the winners and losers. This is survival of the fittest. Whichever app people buy the most, that's going to be the winner. And so we have hundreds of millions of people, one at a time, deciding which of these applications is going to survive and be worthy and which aren't going to be around in a couple of years. And that, to me, is one of the most attractive parts of the mHealth space. All these things are already paid for. No third-party involvement, no government involvement, no insurance company involvement yet. And so you have something that is as close to a pure free market model as you're going to find that's actually reality. As a result, there's downward pressure on pricing. All these applications are dirt cheap. Most of them, with the exception of these apps for ringing in the ears, are all $5 or less. You know, you can bet that the Fitbit device, which costs probably $25 to make and $100 to buy, if there was a medical version of that, it'd probably cost $1,000 or more, just because it would be an insurance reimbursable item and have all of the burdens of classic medical devices that cost way more than they should. I also like the fact that this whole process is patient-driven, right? This was my patient, right? I'm talking about the story of my patient with the Fitbit. My patient came to me and said, I've got an idea. Here's what I did, and it turned out very well. And that's the way this is going to work. The revolution in healthcare, however it happens and whenever it happens, is going to be something that, if it's patient-driven, has the highest chance of being successful. The other extreme is, you know, with this particular patient, they used a Fitbit device to get sleep data. And I mentioned earlier that if we went through traditional medical channels, it would have cost thousands of dollars to get the data. Sleep studies are a classic example. This is becoming a very political, very tightly regulated part of what an ear, nose, and throat doctor does. The sleep specialists are trying to establish and maintain a monopoly. And as a result of all the regulation and all the politics and all the stuff that's going on, this stuff is getting more and more expensive, and the customer service is getting poorer and poorer. We've reached the end of the segment. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
For years, Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center has been providing outstanding care to patients of all ages. They are dedicated to patient satisfaction and have been the recipient of the Georgia Otolaryngology Association Patient Satisfaction Award. They welcome any questions you may have about their services. Their practice includes treatment of asthma, allergies, sleep apnea, snoring, hearing impairments, and chronic sinus disease. Dr. Elena George is a board-certified ear, nose, and throat surgeon. Her training in New York has included training at Manhattan Eye, Ear, and Throat Hospital and Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. She believes in practicing both the art and science of medicine. All patients are seen by Dr. George. All treatment options are discussed, and time will be spent to answer all questions. Their office is located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road in Suite 260 North Tower, two blocks south of Piedmont Hospital. They are open Monday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. until 4 p.m. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. At Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center, you can be confident that you are in good hands with their professional team.
Membership. Are you an IHC member? Access to the Institute for Healthcare Consumerism's breaking news, industry trends, expert blogs, and networking with IHC's industry-wide member community. IHC membership puts you at the focal point of the dynamic health and benefit industry, allowing you to join the conversation and collaborate with industry stakeholders and your peers. Your IHC membership includes a subscription to Healthcare Consumerism Solutions Magazine, Healthcare Exchange Solutions Magazine, annual publications Healthcare Solutions Superstars, and Healthcare Solutions Outlook. a free white paper, and much more. Sign up as a free IHC member or $99 premium IHC member today at www.theihcc.com. That's www.theihcc.com.
This is americaswebradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. You are still listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, a 501c3 nonprofit organization devoted to the education of patients, the empowerment of patients, and patient free choice in healthcare. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thanks so much for spending some time here today. Well, it turns out that they have let me out of the cage. And this show is coming to you from lovely Steamboat Springs, Colorado, the home of the 6th annual Freedom Conference, which begins tomorrow, sponsored by the Steamboat Institute. So this should be a very interesting event. I also hope to get a little bit of mountain biking in using my favorite mobile health app called Map My Ride, which for those of you who ride bicycles is a good way to keep up with your exercise and your level of fitness. And it's relevant to the topic we're addressing today, which is mobile health, or healthcare through your smartphone, otherwise known as mHealth by the folks in the IT industry. They always have to come up with a term that starts with a lowercase letter and then starts with a whole word with an uppercase letter, like iPod or iPad or email. So this has to be called mHealth. That's fine. In the last segment, we were talking about all the great things that mHealth can do. And we were talking about the fact that we have 5 billion human beings on the planet that have a smartphone and can be connected to their physician at any time, any way, anyhow. And that the applications that are being developed for mHealth are in a relatively unregulated environment. They are in an environment that is free from the interference from third-party payers. This is something that patients buy the smartphones, patients buy the applications, patients buy the peripheral devices with their own funds. That means they're cheap. That means they work. And that means, potentially, better health care for a lower price. If we go back just one more time and talk about the story of the patient who came to me a couple of weeks ago and documented with objective data from his Fitbit, a mobile device that links to your smartphone and monitors your movements and your calories and the distance you travel and, relevant to this, the quality of your sleep. And he came to me and demonstrated with objective data that his medication was working well. And I thought this was great. And it turns out the Fitbit's got some research behind it, not much, a couple of studies, to prove that in other medical settings that a device that can monitor patients' movements and level of activity can be very beneficial. In particular, for my specialty of ear, nose, and throat, I was very excited because we have a very difficult time getting good data regarding patient sleep quality. And that's relevant to us because we treat obstructive sleep apnea because that's a problem with the upper airway. That's what ear, nose, and throat covers. It occurred to me that I would love to build my own device or my own app that uses a Fitbit to monitor quality of sleep by number of arousals, number of movements, and combine that with a device called a pulse oximeter, which is an oxygen sensor. The docs know what that is. It's a very non-invasive, inexpensive device. Looks like a clothespin. Goes on your fingertip. It can measure from second to second the oxygen level in your blood. And if we could combine an app that measures the oxygen levels and correlates those with arousals measured by the Fitbit, you might have something that's for just a couple of $100 a patient can buy and can monitor the quality of their sleep every single night. And we can know whether our interventions to improve their quality of sleep are working on a night-to-night basis. Right now, that's completely unavailable. And the sleep industry, the specialty of sleep medicine, has got some very strong political battles going on. They're trying to keep a stranglehold on that and keep ear, nose, and throat doctors and other kind of doctors out of that specialty. And as a result of that being so restricted, the quality of customer service in that industry to referring physicians is going down like a stone. This would be a great way to fix that by a free market solution. Now, one other thing that we couldn't get to at the end of the last segment, I'm going to just mention it here, is that if you take these devices, Let's take my theoretical device, a Fitbit that measures movements during sleep, a pulse oximeter that measures oxygen levels during sleep, and now we link that going the other way so that instead of a patient having to bring that data to me manually, like this patient of mine did, that it's connected on a continuous basis. So I'm getting data every day from all of my patients that have monitors, and I can monitor what they're doing from day to day. Two good things happen. One is we can pick up problems before they come back and see the physician, and the other is we can get a huge amount of data on population health. So think about the potential for something like this. I mean, sleep apnea is kind of peripheral. The big fish are congestive heart failure, diabetes control, blood pressure control. And imagine if you could monitor all those patients in real time and pick up problems before they come into the emergency room. Think about the ways we could improve care and reduce costs with that kind of a model. So that's all the good things, and that kind of finishes up what we were getting into in segment two. The real purpose of the third segment here in the hour is now we're going to take the other side. I promised you I would do that. I'm not just here to preach the gospel of information technology. If you've heard any of my shows, you know that's not how I roll. I've given you the good side. Now we're going to talk about the bad side, and there is definitely a downside. So as an introduction to this, let's talk about a keynote speech that was given at the meeting of mHealth, which is called the mHealth Summit. It's held every December. And a couple of years ago, the keynote speaker was the then director of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius. So she gives this keynote speech at the mHealth Summit a couple of years ago, and of course is berating doctors because we're Luddites and we're idiots and we're ossified and we're worthless because we don't just jump on this technology, without looking, jump in the water without looking. And she gives this example. So here's the example she gives. She says, say you have a rash on your foot. Now, why with congestive heart failure, diabetes, and hypertension out there, she has to pick a rash on the foot as the example, but let's go with it. So you got a rash on your foot. So in the mHealth utopia, you take a picture of the rash, you send it to somebody, they look at the rash, they give you a diagnosis, they give you a treatment, and it's all done faster, better, cheaper, without having to leave your job and go to the doctor, and everything's perfect, right? Well, maybe not. Here's the problem, is that that kind of medicine doesn't fit the way we practice medicine right now. And there's a reason that we practice medicine the way we do. It's because it's the best way and because it works. Now, I'm not saying that we do need to evolve how we practice medicine to incorporate these technologies eventually. But for the folks in the IT industry and the government to suggest that it's a simple matter of buying the technology, plugging it in, turning it on, and heading straight to utopia, that's a pipe dream that doesn't work. So let's go into why this doesn't work, and you have to kind of delve into how physicians are trained, how we do our job. Right, one of the first things that we learn in medical school when we chart our clinical training, right after the 2 years of basic science, the second 2 years of medical school, is the clinical training for those of you who aren't physicians. And the first thing that they teach you is to treat the whole patient. You don't just treat a piece. You don't just treat this little picture of a rash on somebody's foot without knowing what's going on with the rest of the patient. And that's something that most IP people have no understanding of, and there's no government bureaucrat that has any kind of understanding of that. So let's give an example. If you come into my office, I'm an ear, nose, and throat doctor. I do head and neck cancer surgery as well. If you come into my office and you have, let's say, a lump on your neck or an enlarged thyroid, common things that I see, or an abnormal voice or something else, the first thing that I do after looking over this chart and the stuff that you filled out is I walk in the exam room, I introduce myself, I close the door, and I step back about 5 feet, and I look you over from head to toe. I want to know how you look. I want to know how you talk. I want to know how you walk. I want to know everything about you that I can pick up in 4 or 5 minutes of conversation about what your symptoms are and why you're here, why you're in my office. And any doctor can tell you that you learn a great deal more than just what the symptoms are and what the problem spot on your body is. We look at all kinds of things. We look at social issues. Who came with you? Did your parents come with you? Did your children come with you? Did your spouse come with you? And if they did, you know, who's driving the process, right? One example is, you know, a 60-year-old guy who's coming in with a rough voice. The wife dragged him in. He thinks there's nothing wrong. It's the wife that's driving the process. So as I'm doing this visit, who do you think I'm going to be talking to besides the patient? Well, I got to make sure that the wife is satisfied because she's the one who brought him in. the patient in this particular example I'm giving you thinks his voice is fine, doesn't think there's anything wrong. Now, clearly I need to talk to him as well. But if I don't talk to the wife and I don't satisfy her concerns, I've not done my job. And they're going to walk out and the wife is going to be unhappy. And they're going to say, the doctor walked in, just did two or three quick things, turned on his heel and walked out. And that was terrible. And they're not going to send their friends to me and I'm not going to keep my waiting room occupied. So, you know, we need to do these things. We also need patient characteristics, right? You know, some patients are very stoic about their symptoms, right? This 60-year-old guy whose wife came, who dragged him in the office I'm talking about, he's probably very stoic about his symptoms. He might be terribly ill. And if you ask him how he feels, he's going to tell you fine, right? I have a classic example of somebody like this. It's actually not a 60-year-old male. It's actually one of my favorite patients on the planet. If you're listening, you know who you are. This lovely lady was a substitute teacher for my daughter, Margaret, at her school a few years ago. But she is a classic example of someone who never, ever tells you whether or not she's sick. And one day, she came in, and the first thing out of her mouth was, I really don't feel very well. And as soon as I heard that coming from her, I knew there was a big problem, and we talked a little bit about her symptoms, and I said, okay, we're getting you out of here. We're taking you straight for a chest x-ray, and sure enough, she had a screaming pneumonia. How did I know that? Because she took a simple complaint like, I don't feel very well, which on paper doesn't sound very remarkable, not impressive at all, but I knew coming from her, because I know her, that that was a big problem, that she was very sick, and I got a chest x-ray. Turns out I was right. Now, you have people on the other extreme that are very dramatic about their symptoms, and you have to take the opposite approach and kind of turn it down and say, okay, I hear what you're saying, but let's kind of look at some more objective data because there are other people on the other end of the spectrum. Sorry, I'm diverging about patients. One thing that you'll learn if you spend enough time in the doctor's lounge and you spend enough time talking to doctors is that we like to talk about our patients. And we like to talk about particular patients because good doctors are very emotional. They're very passionate about what they do. The patients that we can do well with and the patients we make good pickups make us feel great. You know, patients where if there's a problem or you know, we don't get exactly the result we want and we can feel awful about it. And that's just – that's the way doctors work. And one of the things that I want to do when it's my turn to do this show every other Thursday is give you non-physicians insight – into what makes physicians tick. And the physicians among you, I want to give you some affirmation about why you feel the way you feel. So that's part of what we're doing. So getting back to this whole thing about how doctors evaluate patients, how good doctors evaluate patients, is I not only have to figure out what's wrong with you, but I got to figure out who you are, how you live, and how the way you live your life impacts upon your health. Because it's rare that I only give a prescription and send you out the door. Usually I'm going to give you a prescription and talk about habit changes, talk about diet changes, talk about lifestyle changes, how much you're abusing your voice, how much you're smoking, how much alcohol or how much caffeine. It's a total patient approach. And that kind of a total patient approach is not compatible with the Sibelius scenario of you're going to see a rash on your foot and you're going to take a picture of that rash and you're going to send that to a doctor and all they get is a picture of a rash and they're going to make some kind of miraculous diagnosis and go right to IT Utopia. It doesn't work that way. You're listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The United States Justice Foundation since 1979 has been dedicated to instructing, informing, and educating the public on legal issues confronting America. That means you and me. When necessary, this nonprofit organization has had to litigate to present the constitutional view. Since 1980, USJF has submitted testimony to the U.S. Senate on all but one U.S. Supreme Court nominee. Learn more about USJF by visiting their website at www.usjf.net. Support this nonprofit as it defends our rights, our liberty, and our Constitution.
Come on, follow Sniffles to Atlanta's go-to center for breathing easy. Do you suffer from chronic sinus headaches, recurrent sinusitis, facial pain or pressure, and chronic congestion? Well, balloon sinuplasty just could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
FollowSniffles.com. We treat the problem, not the symptom. Chronic sinus symptoms, gone. This could be the cure you're looking for.
Follow me and breathe easy.
This proven in-office procedure can have you breathing easy, back to work the next day, and it's done under local anesthesia. Get lasting relief, a quick recovery, and start breathing easy again.
Follow me and breathe easy.
Follow sniffles.com.
This is Michael Gano with Insight to Israel. Every day, the Israeli Defense Force finds itself on the front line of the war with the militant arm of Islam. Surrounded by enemies from within and without, they fight for the only Jewish state. Military service is mandatory, ladies serving 2 years and men serving 3 right out of high school. While young people in other democracies are busy traveling or attending university, Israeli men and women gear up for basic training. In a world of heads of state, politicians, ambassadors, diplomats, and a leftist media, many times our voice at the grassroots level is drowned out. So we started an ongoing project called Hershey's for Heroes. Patriot conservatives from all over the U.S. are sending Hershey's chocolate bars with a note of thanks for defending Israel. Won't you join us by sending a sweet message to the IDF? For information, please see my Facebook page at Michael Gano. Thank you, God bless Patriot conservatives, and God bless Israel in her struggle for sovereignty and security.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back. You are still listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. It is the fourth segment, and you and I are both still here. And if you are still hanging with me in the fourth segment of the hour, more power to you, especially if you are not my wife, my mother, or my kids. I am delighted that you have hung with me to the fourth segment, and I promise you it will be worth your while. Unfortunately, I did not calm down during the commercial break, and I am still fired up about this whole idea that high-tech healthcare, healthcare through your smartphone, is inherently a compromise. And it deprives the physician and the patient of the doctor-patient relationship unless we do this slowly and carefully and do it just right. I do believe this technology is coming eventually, and I do believe that it can do a lot of good, but we need to be careful because it can do a lot of harm as well. So we were talking about some of these ways that, if not done properly, mobile health or mHealth or healthcare through your smartphone can do you wrong as a patient. And we were talking about all of the nuances, all of the subtle cues, all of the things that you can't put down on paper and you can't put in a computer program and you can't put on a smartphone that doctors do to treat patients just right and treat every patient just a little bit different based on who they are and how they live and what they're made of. So we had talked about the diagnosis phase. I talk to a patient, I get to know them, I kind of see what they're all about. We need to talk about the treatment phase, which is where we make suggestions as to what treatment options may be best. And the key word here is options. I try, at least as part of my bedside manner, never to be dogmatic and offer just one option. What I try to do is offer more than one treatment option, and when I put these different options on the table, I am watching the patient very, very closely. I am looking at whether they look happy at a suggestion, whether they look frightened at a suggestion, because patients bring very different biases to the table. Some people are very anxious to undergo aggressive treatment options such as surgery because they may bring an experience to the table where a family member had cancer and didn't operate until it was too late. So they're very aggressive about wanting to diagnose possible cancer, treat cancer aggressively, and not fall to the same mistake that they saw perhaps a friend or a loved one go through. Or you may see just the opposite. You may see someone who had a friend or a loved one who underwent surgery and had a bad experience. And as you put options in front of folks, whether it's a surgical option or non-surgical or something else, you can see their reaction, not only by what they say, but the look in their eye and what they do. And you react based on what you see and try to come up with a option that's either choice one, choice two, or a hybrid of the two, or some sort of a synthesis of something truly unique that gives them a sense that, number one, not only are they getting good care, but number two, that they have been truly listened to. Because a big piece of a good healthcare experience with a physician is just for the patient to come in and express themselves. Sometimes that's all they want to do. Sometimes we go through a 10, 15, 20-minute conversation, and at the end, there really isn't anything that needs to be done that's objective, like a prescription or an operation or speech therapy or something like that in my particular field. They just needed to come in and talk about it. They just needed to come in and express themselves and make sure that in spite of all their symptoms and everything that you find on their examination, that they're going to be okay. Sometimes that's all you need. Now, can a computer do that? Can a smartphone do that? Can an app do that? I would say not. So I become very frustrated when I see articles like the one I reviewed, one of the articles I reviewed for the show, in which a writer cited a study that suggested that if we used mHealth, mobile health, healthcare through your smartphone, to eliminate all doctor visits, right? Every doctor visit becomes a virtual visit. No more face-to-face encounters of any kind. First off, that's a completely ridiculous proposition in the first place. But they said if we were to do that, that we would save, the healthcare system would save, and this is a direct quote from the article, a jaw-dropping $6 billion. A jaw-dropping $6 billion. So think about that. Well, that sounds like maybe that's a jaw-dropping number until you realize that $6 billion out of a total annual healthcare budget of $2.98 trillion, which is the number I found, that $6 billion becomes, you know, somewhere on the order of 0.1% or 0.1% of 1%. And if you consider that, then the only reason that figure becomes jaw-dropping is if you're yawning. And there's so much written in the IT field by people that just don't understand the finances of medicine, the art and science of medicine, and it's misleading the whole movement, and it's doing the movement a disservice. That's not a good thing. So we'll move on to some other subjects here. We are still on the topic of what's the potential pitfalls of mHealth or mobile health. What are the other things that are bad? Well, here's another problem. The problem is who's going to pay for it? Who's going to pay for it? Right now, healthcare insurers, health insurers, you know, Blue Cross, Humana, all of them, doesn't matter, don't, as a rule, cover anything that has related to mobile health. They don't even cover telephone conversations. The only thing that they will pay a provider for in terms of direct care is a face-to-face visit. There are billing codes for telephone conversations, but if you try to submit one of those billing codes to an insurer, odds are all you're going to get back is a bunch of laughter. You're not going to get any money. And so that leaves doctors in a rather unpleasant position. That means, let's say I see you as a patient, we order a few tests, and it's pretty obvious that some of these tests can be reviewed over the phone. Right, that happens a lot. So I have two choices. I can offer the patient to review them over the phone, or I can say, look, you need to come back for a face-to-face conversation about these results and give some interpretation and some treatment options. Now, it's definitely far more convenient for me to do this over the phone, but guess what? If I do it over the phone, I don't get paid, and I'm working for free, and I shouldn't have to work for free. So, you know, I have been lectured in the past by people I know well that I should be doing this for a higher calling. It shouldn't matter about the money at all. I should be doing this just for the honor and the glory of medicine. Don't lecture me, please. I don't need to hear that. You know, the bottom line is I got overhead. I got payroll. And after that's all done, I need to come home and have the money to pay the mortgage and feed the family and send the kids to school and all those sorts of things. And so the idea that I'm going to work for free all the time just doesn't work. So at some point, if mobile health is going to advance in a third-party environment, and maybe it can advance outside of a third-party environment. We're going to get to that. But to the extent that this is going to advance within the third-party payer setting, which is obviously the dominant setting in this country, there needs to be some sort of change in structure about how that's going to happen. And it's more than just the telephone conversation model. If we talk about some of these fancy models where they're setting up these two-way networks where the patients with diabetes or congestive heart failure or high blood pressure, go home with a smartphone and a wireless sensor that's picking up blood pressure, blood sugar, going to the smartphone and sending the data to the provider, right? Remember, we talked about that could be a great thing. We could gather a huge amount of data and learn a great deal about these common diseases that we don't know now because of our ability to capture minute-to-minute data from thousands of patients. That could be a great thing, but it can also be a bad thing. And the way it can be a bad thing is that think of the work that creates. Now, if I've got thousands of patients out there with smartphones and sensors all streaming data back to my server, who's going to pay for that? Right now, I've got terabytes of data coming in, and I have to process that data if I'm going to do any good with it. And I end up with some change in the standard of care. I end up with some legal obligation to be monitoring that data, right? And there's no medical legal precedent, no guidelines to say what a provider's obligations are once all these terabytes of data come in. So what if a person who is on a diabetes management program, suddenly their blood glucose, you know, spikes to 600 or 800, that data is coming in somewhere, but it gets missed in the piles and piles and terabytes of data, and that patient goes into a diabetic ketoacidosis or a hyperosmolar coma and dies. Who's responsible? Nobody knows the answer to that question. Needs to be worked on. So we got two other issues besides the whole point of how it changes the practice of medicine and it changes the doctor-patient relationship. We also have issues with who's going to pay for it, who's going to pay for the extra work, the extra infrastructure, and who is going to define the new standards of care that must come as a result of the creation of these networks. Nobody knows. Right, we can go back to the Kathleen Sebelius example of the rash on the foot, right? And all I get in that example is a picture of a rash on somebody's foot, and I'm supposed to make a diagnosis. Well, again, I don't get to see the whole patient. What if just, you know, a foot away or 6 inches away from that weird rash, there's a hugely swollen foot, or there's a gangrenous toe, or it's a diabetic foot that's a mess, and I don't get to see that. And therefore, I make the wrong diagnosis, and the patient has a bad outcome. Who's responsible for that? So we have a situation where our litigation system is ready to pounce on all of these potential weaknesses where the standard of care is no longer what it once was, and nobody else is defining what that standard of care is. It's getting defined by default. That doesn't work. And again, I'm not criticizing the individuals who participate in the medical litigation system. This is a system problem. And in a few weeks ago, you know, my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, and his guest at the time, I think this was an early July show, Dr. Jeff Siegel, discussed the ways we could reform the system that compensates injured patients and get out of a tort-based system and get into something else. So I'm criticizing the system. I'm not criticizing the individuals, but I am saying we have a litigation system that's ready to pounce on that because of everything, all the disruptive technology that is in play. Now, the last big problem with mobile health, healthcare through your smartphone, is the issue of patient privacy. And this is really, really big. And we talked about this last time, right? 2 weeks ago, my radio show was all about the privacy. We're going to talk about privacy now with respect to these mobile devices and the sensors that we have attached to our bodies eventually, before long. All right, so let's go back to the Fitbit thing. I keep going back to the Fitbit example. This was my patient who came in. He had a Fitbit on, and he documented his sleep habits changed as a result of the reflux medication. Well, that's a great thing, but it can also be a very intrusive thing. It can also be a very intrusive thing regarding privacy. So here's the problem. This Fitbit is kind of like Santa Claus, right? How does the song go? Right? He knows if you've been sleeping, he knows when you're awake, and he knows if you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. Well, that's what a Fitbit is, right? A Fitbit knows when you've been sleeping, knows when you're awake, and probably knows if you've been bad or good, because the thing's hooked up to your cell phone, it's got your GPS location, and the position sensor probably knows when you're in the bathroom or when you're engaged in very intimate personal relations. And if your partner has a Fitbit on, then the darn thing can probably figure out who you're having those relations with. I'm not exaggerating. I mean, add other sensors for GPS, you know, blood pressure, heart rate, you know, Bluetooth-connected bathroom scales, you know, and pretty soon, you know, we have a situation where not only are we giving up our privacy in general, but we're giving up privacy regarding our personal bodily functions and the most personal of activities. Is that something we want? A lot to think about. We've reached the end. You have been listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is America's Web Radio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.